test. This is an oral history interview about Native American involvement in the Grand Run Valley in Union County with Armand Minkorn. It is Friday, December 16th, 2005. All right. Now, naturally, you and I both know that Grand Run Valley has been a byway, at least, if not a gathering ground for natives from the area for hundreds of years. That's what we're here to talk about today. We're looking for stories, for history of natives that, in particular, have evolved out of Union County. And so I'm here to talk to you about that. What can you tell me?
Well, the history in the Grand Round Valley goes back at least 4,000 years, not a couple hundred. There's archaeological sites in the Grand Round Valley that have been dated 3,500 and even up to 4,000. Le Grand, of course, is known as Kapkapa, which means place of the cottonwoods. And even before the Treaty of 1855 was signed, Le Grand or Kapkapa was the traditional gathering ground for all of the tribes, mainly because of the fish and because of the camas root. But they would gather in the Grand Round Valley, and it was a traditional gathering ground. The last known traditional gathering in Kapkapa was prior to the Treaty of 1855, where they gathered there to talk about the white people, to talk about the treaties that were being struck with neighboring tribes. That was the known, last known gathering, traditional gathering there in Le Grand, just before the Treaty of 1855 was signed.
Were those the treaty signing tribes that met there?
Yes.
Umatilla, Yakima.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Baker, Oregon has two names, Hiuma Penwas and Tayak Timulakum. Baker was the gateway to the Grand Round Valley, to the Blue Mountains. This is an area that was, as it might be termed, guarded because of the Shoshone Bannocks. That was their route to our area, one of their routes to our area. And of course, as we know, the Shoshone Bannocks were our traditional enemies. But this is the two names for Baker. Going further north, Elgin, we call Lako. that means place of the small pine trees. And then going east, Cove, Oregon, we know that as Wewalakitpa. And that means small brooks or small streams coming together. But because our history goes back at least 4,000 years, we have known burial sites over there, but we also have sacred sites. And it was these two components that, through the Cultural Resources Program, that we were able to document and archive such places. We've had many, many inadvertent discoveries in Grand Round Valley because of development, and they've uncovered archaeological sites, but mostly burial sites, and that's very sad. But the occupation there by our people is has been demonstrated very clearly, and even today, as a reminder to us, Island City, there was a battle that took place there with the cavalry, and it was Clarence Burke that told us about this battle, and that there was a long tent near where present-day Island City is, and they were having a religious service like we do today. We're using the drums and the bell. But it was the cavalry that come, and they heard the singing, they heard the drums, and they told themselves that the Indians are getting ready for war. We need to strike soon. And then that's when the battle, they say the battle started. But there was women, children, and old people that were killed near Island City. And right near Island City, there's a small concrete post with a small brass plaque that cites the battle. But what it doesn't cite is the number of Indians that were killed. But Clarence always talked about this battle because the Indians didn't have a chance, and they were worshiping, and the cavalry misinterpreted that.
Are there known burial sites that we have an interest in Union County?
Yes, they're only known to us.
And there are several lots?
Several.
How about the, what was the feeling of the tribe in the recently resolved business with the burials or the bodies that were underneath in the hall at Eastern Oregon University?
The tribes became involved because there was several non-Indians that said, no, there are not Indians buried in this Pioneer Cemetery. We disagreed because there were several inadvertent discoveries right in that area. But there was no clear way to demonstrate that we were not buried in this cemetery. And that's why the tribes became involved. We had a building that was built on top of a cemetery, and they knew that they built on top of a cemetery. So the tribes, along with some local citizens and the university, had at least two meetings now, and the final decision was to leave the burials intact and to seal the entrances to the burial sites. But the university itself is to draft up policy for any ground disturbing activity on campus. We haven't seen that policy yet.
That was an agreement to be done by the university for, in the case of future discoveries?
Yeah. But the in-law hall isn't limited to where the burials are.
Right.
Or anything else. So the university recognized that, and they agreed to make this policy with us, which we have not seen yet. Also, the university agreed to a plaque to commemorate the ones that are buried there, along with the Indian people that are buried there. And we haven't had any communication on that plaque either.
What other tribes and communities use the Grand Ronde Valley besides ours? Can you address that a little bit more? We know it was a meeting ground, but was it used for other purposes? Was it a local highway, I suppose, for our people in that area? Did people actually live there?
Yeah. Again, it's the archaeological sites that show our occupation, where and the kinds of foods and tools they used. It was, in a sense, a highway, because from the Grand Ronde Valley, of course, it leads to the Blue Mountains, but from the Grand Ronde Valley, there was also a path to or a trail to the Powder River, the Burnt River, and the Strawberry Mountains. And that's all within our ceded area as Umatilla tribe. But Umatilla, Walla Walla, and Cayuse were the main tribes that used and occupied the Grand Ronde Valley. Until recently, the Nez Perce, because of the intermarrying between the Cayuse and the Nez Cayuse and the Nez Perce, it's then that the Nez Perces, we shared it with the Nez Perces in using that area. But everything was there, food, fish, everything.
So it was like a gathering, or well, not just a gathering place, but a place to go and would they take things from there and bring them over to our side of the mountain? Was, that, was this just where we would end up at certain times of the year?
According to, and this is, the Grand Ronde was one of the many places that was used because of the foods. And but it's a cycle. People would end up in the Grand Ronde Valley at during the late summer because of the camas and because of the fish that were then coming up to the headwaters. But then they would cycle back. But according to the seasons, how the foods were ready, that dictated where they went. And the Grand Ronde Valley was one of those places, especially for the camas route. And the fish. And the fish.
Were there any ceremonial events that were known to have taken place? Special gatherings of natives in the area at particular times, either before or after white settlement?
I'm sure that there was ceremonies that they had, just like we do today. You know, all of the ceremonies that we have today, were more back in our great grandparents' days, because Indian people were bound by ceremony and tradition because of their relationship to the land, and we had to honor the foods and recognize them in such a way so that we could continue to have those foods that we lived on, that gave us life. It's not like today when you can go to Safeway or McDonald's. Then the ceremonies were specific and they were part of the unwritten law, and today it's no different. So ceremonies, the singing, the dancing, it all took place there.
Did our people trade with other tribes? Was there trade and other sorts of commerce that went on? Would we have conducted that sort of business in that area as well?
Yes. Right at the mouth or the entrance to Ladd Canyon, there's what they call the Stockoff site. And this site is a huge, huge site, archaeological site. But the main source in that Stockoff, what they call Stockoff Quarry, is the basalt. People came there to trade for basalt, that material, to make tools, to make weapons. It was very clear because material from the Stockoff has been traced to Bend, have been traced to Vendée, have been traced to what they call the Wildcat site on the Columbia River, which is just below the John Day Dam. So, and then even there was some source material found at Hanford Reservation, present-day Hanford, because of the archaeological sites there. So people came there to trade not only for the basalt, but the camas, because camas was just abundant. It was everywhere.
And it, only in that area, though.
Only in that area, huh?
Okay, you talked about the battle at Island City. Were there other known battles that took place that have been handed down story-wise to us, or other sorts of major confrontations?
There were many, many battles in the Grand Round Valley, and this is just one of them near Island City. There were a lot of, I guess you call skirmishes or smaller battles with the Shoshone Bannocks. Most of them were with Shoshone Bannocks. There were a few with the Paiutes that took place in the Grand Round Valley. But it was specifically the Cayuse people here that everybody was scared of. They feared the Cayuse. At one point, like Clarence said one time, you know, he said in ancient times, he said there was constant fighting for the Grand Round Valley, and it was the Cayuses that always prevailed, because Shoshone Bannocks wanted that valley because of the abundance of food. But it was the Cayuse people that became known as fierce warriors, and it was the Cayuse people that made their dominance in the Grand Round Valley. But Clarence always used to say that at one time there was a lot of fighting for the Grand Round Valley, and he owned it. But we prevailed, and now today our traditional use area goes clear down to the Powder River. east or west to, along the Strawberry Mountains, up to Willow Creek, along the Columbia, and up to Hanford Reach in Washington State, and then down, then over to Wallawa Lake, and then over. 6.4 million acres is our traditional use area.
Did we ever, or I suppose even after white settlement came, did we ever settle any of those traditional feuds amongst ourselves, say between Shoshone Bannocks or Paiutes?
Not until recently. Our enemies have always been enemies. And it was until the white man come here that we recognized that the white man was too much. There were too many of them. And because of that, it was the Shoshone Bannocks in the late 1880s, just not too long after the railroad track was built here. But that's what Clarence used to talk about too, was the Shoshone Bannocks came here by train in the late 1880s, and they camped at Thorn Hollow, and it was at Thorn Hollow that the Shoshone Bannocks gave us a whip. And because they gave us a whip, it's then that we started forming an alliance with each other, because we couldn't stop the white men coming, they were only getting a larger number. They were taking our lands. They were killing our people. And it was then that Shoshone Bannocks recognized that, and they came here. And that's when our alliance began forming. Two, that's when the Shoshone Bannocks brought the big drum here. So the late 1880s is when we started forming alliances with our traditional enemies.
Was the Grand Drum Valley the source of any major celebrations?
Only the one was the traditional use, traditional gathering area. But I'm sure that, and again, because of the archaeological sites that are there, I mean, there's sites just everywhere. But the main food there was the tamas.
Does the tribe have any talking about more in the more modern or up-to-date era? Does the tribe currently have any projects going on in Union County, Grand Rock Valley?
Yes, we have many. We have fish restoration activities, habitat restoration, cultural resources protection, natural resources enhancement projects. So there's a number of things that's going on in Grand Rapids. Water quality, water quantification, trying to secure water in the Grand Rapids. So there's a number of things that's going on over there.
So Grand Rum Valley is not sitting out in the dark.
No.
I was told by a couple of elders that I interviewed, particularly in the Elgin Imbler region, about they talked about Indians coming to pick up hides from hunters, trade, things like that, with the non-natives over in that. Do you know anything about that? Or this will be, I'm guessing, I think one of these stories was told to me that maybe took place in the 1940s or 50s. So.
Well, I'm sure that there are all those things continued in one way or another, because that's what tradition is about, and that's what seasons and foods are all about. You go to the place where the food is, and you go there because the people before you, and the people before them, and the people before them, they all continue to come back to the same place. As time went on, less and less people continued to do that. And then it come to a point where they don't go there anymore. But friendships, and even the non-Indians, the earlier ones that were here, their descendants remember our descendants that went there. So there was friendships and relationships established because of those generations.
Do we currently have any current celebrations or activities that take place over in the Grand Rum Valley in this day and age?
The only one I know of is at Eastern University, their Mother's Day celebration.
Annual. Did you have any involvement, or have you been to any of the Native arts fairs that used to take place over there in the 70s when were a young adult?
Yeah, I was a young adult once.
Yeah.
And I went to school at University of, it was called Eastern Oregon State College then. But yeah, I remember being at those art fairs.
So you attended Eastern as well?
Yeah.
Well, what did you study? What do you remember from that time?
Forestry, I remember. I was studying forestry then. I was just out of job for December month.
Did you complete your program? Did you live over there?
Yeah, I lived over there for about 2 years.
What part of town?
I was in student housing.
On campus? What was it like to attend Eastern in those days? Did they have a strong Native American program or presence on campus then?
Oh, geez. Back then, they had a very large Indian club. And there were Indians from all over. And they were a strong club then because they had several Indian activities that took place throughout the year. And of course, the biggest one was the Mother's Day, which is still going today. But back then, in the 70s, the number of students, the number of Indian students was high, was really high.
Did you say there were more than 100 on campus?
There were at least 150.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And they were from all over the United States?
All over the United States.
It seemed like Eastern, and we have another person that I hope Paul gets to talk to, which is Lou Farrell. You know, we've been sending students to Eastern for decades or longer, just from this tribe, to go to school. Were there a lot of our tribal members going to school at that time?
Oh, yeah.
Recall?
There was a lot of our Umatilla, there was a lot of Warm Springs. And at that time, there was a lot of Alaska natives going to school. And they had their own club because there were so many of them.
The Alaska natives had their own separate club?
Yeah.
Did they have the same advisor? Or?
How did that work out? I don't know.
Okay. Would you say that it was a good program that they had going there, considering the number of people that went?
Yeah, it was a very good program. It was a very good club because they were well organized. They had their own structure, and they had a very good relationship with people on campus as well as off campus. And that was the thing too, was the Indian Club, they reached out to community members and organizations to help support their activities. And that's what made it so unique, because the committee or the community and local retailers, they all contributed, and that's what made the events so strong.
Now, was this this Mother's Day event that you're talking about, was that already going on when you first started attending Easter?
Yes.
And had that been going for some time by then?
I don't know.
Were you involved in that during your time on campus?
Yes.
Were you doing traditional things like you do today?
No.
At that time?
No. Mm-hmm. I was young and naive, and I just got my supply of funds, so nobody could tell me nothing.
Right. What kinds of things, what were people majoring in the Native crowd that you might have been involved with or knew at that time?
Like, I had two partners from Warm Springs, and it's sad to say they're both gone now. But it seemed like the Indians then, their main focus was the social field, counseling, social services. There were a lot of them that took natural resources, fields, in particular forestry. But then, it seemed like the social services field was one of the top areas that they went into.
Were those the forestry program that you were in, was that a strong program at that time?
Yeah, it was very strong.
Mm-hmm. Very strong. who were some of your classmates from Umatilla at that time from here?
Amos and Tustis, Levi Morrison, geez, I can't remember now.
Did you have any special assistance or other types of help? Was it a struggle academically for natives at that time?
It was,
to go to college.
It was a big struggle because we don't have the assistance we do have now with higher education. Then the tribes did help some, but the majority of the assistance came through loans.
And so you didn't finish your program while you were there. Was that a valuable experience, however, going to school at Eastern?
It was. You know, education, like...
Mint Ordinance, December 16th, 2005, and we're talking, he's finishing a quote, we're talking about Eastern Oregon University and the late Chief Bill Minthorn.
Yeah, Bill Minthorn said at one time, and he recognized it too, he said, you're going to come to a time where you're going to have to learn what the white man is learning. You're going to need the white man education. You're going to need to go to college to survive, to get by. There's always, because there's so many white people, and we live in a dominant society, and we are a minority, we are going to have to be educated as Indians to get along, to prosper, and to grow. Said there's no way around it. We have to get educated. That's what Bill said.
Do you think that there might be more opportunity to interact in the future with university and Native students? What do you see?
The In-Law Hall incident, the president there agreed to come here and meet with us. The Board of Trustees. That kind of interaction is always important because it creates a means or it creates dialogue that that's exchanged on how the university can help us and how we can help the university. So vice versa. Walla Walla College or Whitman College recently installed a new president, and he's very interested in coming here to meet with us. So those kinds of interactions are important, not only because of our Indian students that go there, but how we can help our Indian students and how the college can help us help them.
So that's a benefit.
It is a benefit.
Did you know that when you were going to Eastern in the 1970s, because, you know, I've been over there for a few years attending school, and it seemed common knowledge among, I've talked to some of my friends that went to school there in the 60s and earlier, and a lot of people seem to have known that those bodies were in the basement all along. Any idea why it would have taken decades for that issue to be resolved? Did anybody oppose, did anybody speak up then?
No. I think probably the reason that it's taken this long to become known is because nobody wanted to deal with it. If we don't talk about it, then we don't have to deal with it.
Did you know then?
No.
Okay. also sort of got a take from reading the local media around that time that that previous administrations at the university in the recent past didn't really have a plan to deal with that sort of incident either taking place.
Mm-hmm. I think too, because, well, you know, nobody really wanted to deal with it. And second, nobody had experience in dealing with anything like that. And then third, there was no laws that protected such sites or that could help take care of those kinds of situations.
My understanding was that in America, not Native America, but in many cemeteries were paved over when they got in the way.
Yeah.
And that possibly this might have been an incident, an example of such a thing taking place.
Yep.
Because they covered their own as well.
Yep.
Anything else you can contribute about Union County right at the moment? Stories, events, places?
Well, the only thing is, Union County as a whole and the residents in Union County, and they need to recognize that the tribes in protecting known and unknown sites, we need help. There's state laws, there's federal laws, there's county laws that protect these sites. There are still people knowingly in Union County that continue to dig up our graves, that continue to loot archaeological sites. It's only because their father did it before them and their grandfather did it before them, so they see nothing wrong with it. There are consequences. And the tribes, we can't be everywhere all the time. This is where we need help. Education is probably the biggest tool in dealing with some of these situations. If people knew about the law, if they knew the significance of such sites and resources, that would help alleviate, but it would also give eyes and awareness so that they could make their local law enforcement aware of such things going on.
And do we have a position on things? One thing I've discovered in some of my travels over there in conducting the interviews is that the one thing that's most common of all that's collected that can turn up anywhere is my understanding in yards as well as in public places are arrowheads. It seems likely that as many of those may have fallen or been discarded haphazardly as opposed to taking them from known burial sites or anything like that. Do we have a position on that?
There's a law, there's state law that protects those. A person cannot remove an artifact, an arrowhead. That object is protected by law. Both state and county and even federal law.
Even those that turn up on somebody's private property.
Exactly. And that's the thing too. They may own the property, but they do not own the resources. And a lot of the non-Indians argue, you can't tell me what to do on my land. You can't tell me what I can do or not do with these arrowheads that are on my land. That's the argument. But state law protects those.
In spite of that. So what's the right thing to do, especially for people who possibly have had lots of these things handed down in collections, you know, maybe for generations in their family? It's possible some of these are closely guarded and maybe kept in secret. But what would somebody do to make that right, or sort of still I guess we would say come out win-win.
We had a very large archaeological collection donated to Temastlik in 1997, and this was a family. The elder of that family died, but he collected because his father collected, and his father collected, and they had a very, very large collection of artifacts. And that family, the elder that died, willed that these artifacts go to Hindu people, and that collection came to us. So a lot of people are doing that now.
Is that the recommended thing to do then?
Yes. Or give the collection or donate the collection to a museum or university.
So it wouldn't necessarily have to come right here to our door. So if it were given somewhere to an entity like that, that would go a long way to make it right. I'd like to thank you for participating in our interview. If I can come up with any more questions or things that I think are important, I'll come back. But I appreciate your time.
All right.
Thanks.
Okay.